Stephanie. I was wondering if we could all have a chance to take a look at November's meeting notes for review. See if anybody has any questions.
I move to approve. Second.
Okay. Is that Remy? Second?
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, so I thought we could start off by having everyone introduce themselves and also tell us what you do and who you represent on the council. So my name is Stephanie. I am a nurse practicing in Clark County.
Alan Melnick, I'm the public health director and health officer here.
Lydia Gurman, admin assistant.
Hi, I'm Joan Cayley. I'm a community health nurse, but I sit on the council as the non-elected representative from the city of Vancouver.
I'm Amy Bishop-Smith. I'm the youth representative here, and I'm also a sophomore at Richfield High School.
I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I'm a local small animal veterinarian in Clark County.
I'm Tracy Rood. I am a nurse and I teach at Cascadia Tech Academy. I represent
the
seniors on this council.
I'm Chris Goodwin, the Community Engagement Coordinator at Clark County Public Health.
I'm Marla Sanger. I'm a nurse and I work for Peace Health Southwest and Peace Health St. John Medical Center. I'm the Director for Community Benefit and Advocacy. I'm delighted to be here.
Paul Childers, I represent the restaurant of Clark County.
I'm Roxanne Wolf in Between Swallows, and I work for Clark County Public Health.
Janice Patch, I'm the Chief Performance Officer for Clark County Public Health.
I'm Steve Becker. I'm a consumer of public health services, but I work for Daybreak Youth Services and have an interest in kids' addiction and mental health.
My name is Greg Malk. I'm a physical therapist, and I represent a consumer of public health.
Scott Johnson, I'm the Emergency Manager for Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency, and I'm representing Clark Regional Emergency Services. It's Crescent.
I'm Roy Butler. I'm here for Bob Richardson, who has a council meeting tonight, our chief of police.
Hey, Scott, I'm a non-elected rep of Clark County Cities and Towns. I work for the City of Washington.
Remy Houston, pediatric dentist, and I represent the dental community.
John Roth, I work for Clark Public Utilities as a water quality specialist and represent Clark County Water Utility.
Mark Collier, the septic designer, and I represent designers, installers, and operation maintenance specialists.
Wonderful. So there's a couple updates to the membership. We have two new members that are joining us. One is here, Marla, so we'll give her a chance to introduce herself and a little bit, tell us a little bit more. Someone else that's not here right now is Melanie Marino. She represents Social and Human Services. And then there's still an open seat for the Clark County Federal recognized tribal member. So, Marla, would you be willing to tell us a little bit more about your background?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Let's see. I guess I'll start with my favorite things, which are my family. I have a husband of 44 years, and he owns and operates a fish and charter business on Prince of Wales Island in Alaska, and this will be his third year doing that. So we have a strong love for Alaska, and the enjoyment that we've had is very small business. We just take one group at a time, so they're like our friends. My work history has been initially, I took nursing school right out of high school. I worked my way through nursing school at Children's Hospital as a nursing assistant, and then went into the infant ICU when I got my RN degree. And I did lots of different things at Children's Hospital. My last gig there was 7 years running an ER, which was so interesting that I could never watch it on TV because it just doesn't get better than real life. And then I, during that time, I got my MBA. So I thought, you know what now? And I went to work for Peace Health up in Bellingham, and I did quality improvement work. I also had some oversight for clinical operations. And then I continued in that for quite a while. My job moved to Vancouver. I was delighted because our daughters live in Portland, and my husband and I were hoping to have a good excuse to move here. And then after we just gotten almost settled in Battleground, which is, we love living there, I was asked if I'd go help out a hospital on Wrangell Island in Southeast Alaska that had just kind of suffered a collapse politically and socially, and they had completely unseated their entire hospital board all at once and then fired the CEO the next day and had a bad review from the state, and it was going down real fast. So I couldn't think of anybody else who would do it, so I ended up going there. My husband came with me, and what was supposed to be 1 year turned into 3 years. But they're back on their feet and able to remain independent for the time being. And I came back to, you know, who knows what, and I ended up getting to work as the director of community benefit, which is really something very dear to my heart. We have two daughters that live in Portland, and so we get to see them all the time now, and life is really good. I'm just delighted to have been invited by Alan to have the opportunity to be with all of you.
Wonderful. Well, welcome. All right, so we were just wondering if we could have a few minutes for any public comments, just an opportunity for, I don't know if we have anyone from the public attending, right? So we're good? Okay.
Well, I have stuff, but I'm just going to do it at 7:45.
Okay. All right.
And do not talk before.
I mean, I do not have a cookie in my mouth.
May I throw in a plug?
Sure.
A quick one. Daybreak is on track to open first of its kind 58-bed inpatient adolescent mental health and addiction treatment center in Brush Prairie coming up in early June. We look forward to showing you all around sometime soon.
Wonderful.
Well,
I can go now.
Sure.
Okay. I just was before this at 4:30 this afternoon. Self and Swell released the State of the Children report from Southwest Washington. And I want to highlight a couple of things, and then I have this. The State Department of Early Learning last year set a goal that by 2020, 90% of our five-year-olds would be ready for kindergarten, with race, ethnicity, and family income no longer predictors of readiness. And this is the first school year that all kindergartners have had the comprehensive assessment. So this is a base. This is baseline data for us. And it is a bundled measure. So there are six different indicators that are bundled together. And the six different indicators are six domains: social, emotional, physical, language, cognitive, literacy, and math. So in some of our school districts and in some of our areas, some of those numbers may be higher, but the goal is to have all of the children meet all of them. So at the statewide level, the percent who meet all six of those characteristics is 47%. In Clark County, as an average of all of our school districts, we're at 43. But then you go down and just link these numbers with what we know to be areas of low income or poverty. Battleground's 59%, so it's higher. Camas, 71%. We know that socioeconomic status in Camas is higher. Evergreen, 37%. We know there's a lot of poverty, low income going out into Evergreen. Green Mountain, 71%. Hawkinson, 54%. La Center, 61%. Ridgefield, 47%. Vancouver, 32%. And Washougal, 45%. So we have and if you look at the region, Southwest Washington, only 42%, because our region also includes Cowlitz, Klickitat, Skamania, Pacific, and Wakayakum counties. What that means is 58% of our kids are not ready for kindergarten in those particular areas. So we went through the different elements on the report this afternoon, and of course the nurse family partnership is cited in the report, and I just wanted to give you one statistic which I've talked to you about before. Children not reading at grade level by the end of the third grade are four times less likely to graduate from high school on time, six times less likely for students from low-income families, and high school dropouts were 63 times more likely to be incarcerated than college graduates. So these are some of the, you know, the social determinants that are linked to all this importance of early learning. And we know that most of brain development occurs by 5 years of age, and we have to do some more work. One of the Nobel laureate economists, James Heckman, has done a lot of work, and from those of us in public health, we know that if we invest, we're going to get a return on that investment. And James Heckman has said that there's a 13% per year return on investment by starting early with comprehensive, early, high-quality, birth-to-five early education. And that doesn't necessarily mean a child has to go to an organized child care, but it means parents need to know about things. Like one of the stories that's in here comes from the Nurse Family Partnership or a Parents as Teachers program about a simple measure about a mom living in a chaotic environment and child is developmentally delayed because the mom doesn't know about tummy time for the baby and there's no place in this house with all this chaos to put the baby on the tummy. And then there's some examples from Nurse Family Partnership. So we only printed a few copies of the hard copy report, but I do have for every one of you a card with the URL with the number. So if you would take one. And there's more data, of course, on the website. And then the second thing is I was at an ACEs Action Alliance team leader meeting this afternoon. And we're having, next Tuesday is our general alliance meeting in the afternoon at 2:30 to 4. And there is an ACEs 101 presentation at 1:30. If any of you would like, if you're not aware of ACEs and are interested, you're all invited to participate in the meeting next week. And we were planning out our activities for this, for the next year in terms of our programming, et cetera. And of course, we all on the council put ACEs as one of our priority issues. And one of the things that came up that I was specifically charged to ask Alan about was the status of the Medicaid expansion toolkit, because there's ACEs content in that toolkit.
I believe so. Yeah, well, the Medicaid waiver specifically calls out the Nurse Family Partnership as well.
So do we know anything about when that's going to, I mean, the toolkit's been approved and we're waiting for the counties to apply for it, is that?
Yeah, that's another, I can go into a little bit here, yeah. But the Southwest Washington Regional Health Alliance is no longer the Southwest Regional Health Alliance, it's now the Southwest ACH, Hannibal Community of Health, or SWATCH. It now has two the board has split and we have a much smaller board which basically has a fiduciary responsibilities and supervises the executive director. And then the other piece that has been formed is called the Regional Health Improvement Plan Council, or RIP Council, and I may be getting it incorrect, but the RIP Council is the organization that's going to actually do the work around the Medicaid waiver. And a number of us, I'm on the RIP Council. Marla, you on the board? You're on the RIP Council, right?
No, I'm on the board.
And I don't know if there's any other folks here, but we have representation both on the RIP Council and as well as on the board. And basically be looking at what kind of projects folks are going to be doing through the Medicaid waiver process. And we're still just getting started on that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Yeah, well, we're particularly interested in the toolkit. We understand there's not only Nurse Family Partnership, but some very specific expectations and language about ACEs that we thought we'd like to know about it on our ACEs Action Alliance. And once that toolkit is published,
Yeah, I need to look at and there is a toolkit that you can go ahead and get. And actually, you probably looked through it too, Marla. It's
really great.
It's available on the, I'm forgetting the name of the, we can get the website for everybody, but some of us have downloaded the toolkit. Yeah, there is a toolkit, and I might even, if I have time to look, when I'm not yakking, I'll look through my files.
You could send that out because we're interested in knowing.
Yeah, we'll get the toolkit. We'll get the toolkit out to everybody.
Thank you.
When's the meeting?
It's the ACEs Action Alliance.
And that's next week.
Uh-huh, it's on Tuesday. We usually meet once a month. Next week we're meeting on Monday, or on Tuesday, at 2:30. Let me tell you the location, just a second. Somehow, I'll get it for you in a minute. I'll come up in a minute. Just like Alan, I'm having some technical difficulty.
All right, should we move on to department updates? So
Dr. Melnick, did you want to start?
Yeah, so let me go ahead and get started with number one. The item number one is under the budget, and we're going to tag team several other. Roxanne and Janice are also going to talk a little bit about some of this stuff. I'm going to start with priority-based budgeting. So the county is moving towards what's called priority-based budgeting, and this is something that's been done in counties throughout the United States. There are a number of and other local jurisdictions, cities as well as counties. So what it is it's a way of taking a look at all your programs and figuring out, looking at them and figure out where, if you have a limited amount of resources, where you basically want to allocate those dollars so they have the, you know, they go where they're most needed. And actually, we've been doing this in our health department. We're kind of, I guess I have to brag about this, but we're the shining star in the county that, and actually Jeff has a lot to do with this as well, is that we've really, our budgeting process has really been organized around program codes, and we can actually take a look at the different programs and see what's going into them, what resources going into them. Other departments haven't been as far along as we've been. So we've done it within our department, but now the county is actually going to have all the departments and all the programs in the county go through this priority-based budgeting process. So everybody is in the process of developing their program budgets as well as their program narratives and describe what each program does. And it gets a little bit complicated. You can't, when you're describing a program, it can't be too big and it can't be too small. It has to make a lot of sense. And you're nodding your head. I don't know whether you did that, and the healthcare system does some of this stuff.
So I try, but I think that's exactly the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, and actually when you think about it, it's like if you were to build everything back up, if you had a pot of money and you were to build everything back up again, where would you put those dollars? So, and we've been doing this when we had to respond to the cuts and all that, we had a system that we could actually think about this stuff. Basically, but the Board of County Councilors is now, they have the budgetary authority, so they're basically going to be looking at this countywide. And they're going to be doing a self-assessment later this summer, including a peer review assessment. I'm sure the board will have questions that we need to answer, which we will do. And if there's some differences between where we're at and where our board is, we'll be engaged with conversations around them. But basically, this is where the county is moving, and this is where a lot of jurisdictions around the country are moving. And I don't have anything. I don't know if you guys want to add anything beyond that. We're familiar with it because we've been doing it. So, okay,
that goes along with the foundational public health services.
We're going to talk about the foundational public health services in a moment.
That lays the foundation for.
Well, that's a good question. A lot of the programs. So the foundational public health services, foundational public health services have both programs within them and capabilities. So they're a listing of programs as well as capabilities. And I'm going to talk about this in a minute, but there are programs within that and capabilities that I think would rise to the top. The county's going to be looking at this countywide, so you know, other departments, the sheriff's office, and things like that. But I would think, as I get into the FPHS discussion, I think those things would rise to the top in terms of high priority. And some of them, as you know, are mandated as well, so we have to do them. You know, we're going to go through this priority-based budgeting process, but some of the programs, like the environmental health programs and communicable disease and vital records, are mandated as well. So that adds to the mix. I don't know if that answers your question, but we're going to talk more about FPHS in a few minutes. I think one of you guys is on, and unless there's other questions about priority-based budgeting.
I think I was just getting at, the core functions of public health and, you know, I mean, basically public health has done away with all any kind of direct services. I mean, there's hardly anything left to meet those core functions of, you know, policy and assurance. And so, you know, it's like, I don't know how much more performance-based. I mean, that's like we may be adding if you're going to go back to that, not just reducing, but increasing if you come up with a priority-based budgeting.
Yeah, I think that's the benefit of priority-based budgeting, too, is it's a much more transparent process, and it levels the playing field a little bit. And we have an opportunity to say, you know, maybe there are some reasons why we want to increase, and we would have the opportunity to really discuss that in terms of priority and why this might be a program that we really want to support going forward over others. But again, all of our departments are going to be doing that, and it makes it a much more fair process too, because if everyone is going to have to go through this process where that has not been the case in the past. So it's going to really help us in that dialogue that we have with our counselors so that they better understand the work that we do. A lot of times our work does not necessarily have an ROI for public health per se, but there's some downstream benefits that help with, for instance, juvenile justice and the stuff that you were talking about earlier, Joan. And so that also helps us to tell that story.
And, you know, when we interact on priority-based budgeting, we're talking about putting the resources where they're needed. We're going to be at the table talking about effectiveness, evidence-based, prevention, and, you know, this is an opportunity for us to get all those points across in terms of, you know, how you set your priorities.
And so I'm going to talk about the reductions that we recently had, and this kind of goes in line with that priority-based budgeting. As you all know, there was recently a exercise that we had to go through because there was a big budget deficit in the county. And ultimately, this priority-based budgeting will allow us to do that process in a more fair way rather than just saying, okay, across the board, you're just going to have to take a 10% cut across the board. It really gives an opportunity to really look at what are the programs that make sense to keep pulling, where are some other areas that we might want to cut from. Unfortunately, when we went through this last exercise, we didn't have the benefit of having this priority-based budgeting in place. And so basically, we kind of had to look at that sort of 10% across the board, which is not optimum. And we had some reductions that hit our department in our chronic disease prevention program. One of the criteria was positions that are actually funded a lot through our general fund, and positions also that some of the work may be able to be done by a community provider. That doesn't mean that it won't be done by a community provider, but that was one of the criteria that was looked at. So in the end, our chronic disease prevention program ended up with two FTEs that were reduced in this exercise, and also a portion of our public information officer. Well, luckily, we've been able to find another position for one of those people that was kind of in the chronic disease prevention program long ago, who is now in our food team, and he's actually moved over as a food inspector. But what's good about that is that Long not only brings, you know, a wealth of health education information experience, but he also can maintain that historical knowledge that we have in public health. So we were really excited that we were able to keep him within our department. Teresa Cross is the other one. She's done a tremendous amount of work on our tobacco and vaping. She was really instrumental in getting our ordinance passed and helping with that language. She actually was offered a job in Oregon with the Oregon Health Authority. And although we were looking at other positions for her here, we didn't have those set in stone yet. And she got an opportunity with Oregon Health Authority, and she decided to take that. So we're really happy for her. She's going to do some great work there. But we were unfortunately unable to save that historical knowledge within our department. So we're continuing to work on that, and like Alan said, going forward with priority-based budgeting, I think we'll have a better opportunity to not sort of have to take that large hit as we've done in the past. There may still be hits, but we'll be able to have an opportunity to really prioritize those programs. Do you agree, Alan?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great summary.
So anyway, so we're moving forward there. I also wanted to give a quick NFP update. So Marla, you're kind of in this conversation as well. So Marla from Peace Health has been at the table and having conversations around our NFP program. As you all probably remember, NFP is one of those other programs that has been on the table for a while. It receives a lot of our general fund dollars, and we're looking at ways of sustaining that going forward. And so we're looking at a community-based approach to helping us not only fund the program as it is, but actually sustain it and grow it over time. And there's been some really interesting things that have happened over the past few months. First, we actually have developed a partnership with Cowlitz County, and they were having some difficulties with staffing their NFP program. They basically lost all their nurses, and they were recruiting like crazy and could not find anyone to actually fill those positions. So we worked a I hate to say deal, because that's been in the news so much. We did a deal, but we actually worked on building a relationship around NFP, and we have a shared services now in CalWIT. So Clark County hired two NFP nurses to serve CalWIT County, and CalWIT is actually funding those positions through their $5.
I'm sorry, Roxanne, NFP.
I'm so sorry, Nurse Family Partnership.
Thank you very much.
I'm so sorry, I should have said that name. So I'm just assuming that everyone remembers what all the acronyms are, so. So that's been something that's happened, which is really good. And so there's an expansion of the program, and we're working closely with Peace Health St. John's and that NFP program there to work on services there. We're also looking at having one of our NFP nurses actually housed at Peace Health St. John's, although that isn't done yet, but that's something that we've been discussing, which would be terrific. So that's a very positive development. The other thing that we're working on is we've been having some dialogue with Peace Health and Molina Healthcare. And also our RHA. What is the RHA called now, Alan?
SWATCH, Southwest Accountable Community of Health.
Okay. And again, SWATCH.
SWATCH.
We're on SWATCH Watch right now. But certainly the Medicaid waiver program that you brought up, Jim, there's some potential funding for NFP there. There's also some potential funding with some of our partners. One of the challenges we've had is that with the election and now the potential change with the Affordable Care Act, we're not sure that there's going to be ongoing funding for a community benefit and other dollars that were going to be there for maybe the Medicaid waiver, although we're ever hopeful that there will be. Some of the prevention dollars we do expect will probably be cut. So there's a lot of questions, and that has slowed down some of our conversations with some of our community partners because people are just not sure about where that's
going to
go.
Hey, Roxanne, yeah. Now that you brought that up, it made me think if, you know, one of the things that's potentially on the chopping block with the Affordable Care Act is the Public Health Prevention Fund that's through the Affordable Care Act. It funds 13% of the CDCs. So if you have a moment, you might want to let your elected representative know about preserving the Prevention and Public Health Fund. I'm sorry.
No,
but I mean, even if the Affordable Care Act goes away, to preserve that piece is really critical. And you made me think about that, Roxanne. So, you know, Representative Herrera-Butler, you know, hearing from your constituents and saying preserve that is, like, really an important thing to do.
And it's called the Public Health Prevention.
Public Health and Prevention.
Yeah.
I was going to look this up.
Put that in there. So there's definitely still a lot of positive things going on around that. We're still having very good and positive conversations with our community partners. And we do actually expect, we're pretty optimistic that we're going to continue to have funding for that program going forward. And we'll be able to give you some more updates in the next few weeks, let you know kind of where we're at. But we're still, like I said, we're still moving forward. We're very positive that we're going to be able to not only sustain that program, but actually look at ways of expanding it over time. Any questions?
And actually, now that I think about it, if the FAC wanted to write a letter to the, or support for to the Congresswoman around prevention, that's something that you guys could possibly do as well.
Yeah, that's what I was sort of leading up to. I think that something that we should do as a council, you know, to... We've got to keep prevention. We've got to get money for prevention in this country. We just can't cut that fund. And then I think if we'd be willing to write a letter, I think it would be good for us to do that, representing Clark County.
So what we can do is we can look at our bylaws to make sure that we can do that as
It could be that we ask the Board of Health to do that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, too, for saving me on that one. So,
but we could write a letter to the Board of Health, you know, whoever, but to communicate how important this is. Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, do you want us to draft something to send to Stephanie and Adrian and
Bob
for review?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. The executive committee. Okay. All right. So I was going to give a quick update on our HIV case management transitions. I mentioned in a meeting a while back that we'll be transitioning that to Cascade AIDS Project CAP, which is primarily a Portland organization, but they are opening an office in Vancouver. We got funding from the Washington State Department of Health to use the next 6 months through the end of June. It's not 6 months anymore. This year's already going so fast. Over the remaining till the end of June to support the transition to make sure that our clients have a smooth transition. We hired a consultant that is functioning as an interim program manager during the transition. He actually worked here before. His name's David Field. He managed this program before when it was transitioned to the Department of Community Services and then came back. So he knows a lot about all the technicalities that need to happen to actually transition this program. So he's doing that. We will not have any housing dollars at the end of February because our housing contracts are done, but we will be referring our clients to CAP housing services. CAP is opening an office in Vancouver. I should have brought the address, but it's near, is Dr. Nusser Vancouver Clinic?
No, he's Peace Health and the residency program, and I think their offices are just off of like Main 39th around there, the old hospital building.
And Dr. Nusser already sees probably 2/3 of our clients, so this will be for them, for those clients, really nice way to connect with their provider at the same time they can get case management. So, also housed there will be the STD clinic where we do testing for HIV, Hep B, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis. And the nice thing is they're working with Dr. Nusser with his residents so that he can actually do some treatment of STD. So rather than sending people away saying you have a positive result, you should go get medication, they, especially with syphilis, which is on the rise, they'll be able to get the treatment while they're there.
The other nice thing about it is the residents are getting to see these patients. So the residents are learning, some of us feel that HIV is a primary care disease and you should be able to take care of it. Primary care, these are all family practice residents. So hopefully if they stay in the community, there'll be more access points for people with HIV in the community. So the fact that residents are getting trained is a real good part of it.
Yeah, it's going to be a great, and we'll still be very involved in the STD clinic. While CAP is paying the rent, we will be providing a nurse to do the screening and some treatment, correct? And we'll be down to 3 case managers. One of them is going to be transitioning to CAP in March. So we'll have 2 case managers. So as soon as all the case managers have found other opportunities, have moved on, as they go, we'll transition those clients to CAP.
Okay,
the
timeline is June, correct?
At the latest.
The latest.
Any questions about that?
Well, you mentioned hepatitis C, and I just, a related question, and there's a lot of advertising on TV now about how all baby boomers should be tested for hepatitis C. Is that something we should do, or is that a commercial?
No, that's not a commercial, and actually there should be a lot more access points for folks. There's over 4 million people infected with hepatitis C in the United States, and at least half of them don't know that they are. And many of them need, not only to be aware of it, that they need treatment as well. There is treatment for it. And so that is not just advertisement. It's a time bomb because a percentage of them will go on to, you can have no symptoms and be living with it, and you can go on to chronic liver disease, cirrhosis, and liver cancer. In fact, I think it's become the most common cause of liver cancer. So it's a time bomb for this country, and including our community, and more people need to be aware of it and get opportunities for treatment. So it's not advertising. And those of you baby boomers in the room, if you have been tested, you should be tested.
It's interesting because you see it on TV, but I haven't seen any other kind of messaging about it other than the advertisements
Is it a, like, I think I asked this last time, like, is it a federally funded campaign? Like, is it, or is it by a,
Cardone?
The advertisement?
It's by the
drug company.
The drug company.
Well, the drugs are really expensive, so they've got an incentive, unfortunately, but they're effective. You can clear the virus.
We did have somebody from the Washington State Department of Health come and do a presentation to the Board of Health about hepatitis C and the risk, and especially at our needle exchange, we're seeing quite an increase in hepatitis C. And part of it is because, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, but the hepatitis C virus lives a long time on the surface. So if somebody, you know, it used to be for people using intravenous drugs, it would be don't share a needle. But because of the way hepatitis C lives so long, it's, they can't share their works either. So that's the new sort of campaign we're working with those using the intravenous drugs that don't share your cottons, because you could have it on the cotton, wipe the needle, and, but we could have someone come here and talk about it.
But this also leads into the whole foundational public health services. So the fact that we have a system where we spend more money than anybody else in any other country in the world on healthcare, and we got a couple million people who are not even aware they have Hep C. Mm-hmm. So this is going to lead into the, but I don't know if there's more questions about that, and then we can talk about. Okay, so foundational public health services are basically a set of capabilities and programs that you basically need to have in place everywhere in the country to improve the health and protect the public. And we're doing really, as hard as we're working, we're, public health has been underfunded. Have we talked about this before? I don't want to talk yak too long on this. But basically, the public health system is underfunded. And our Board of Health passed a resolution supporting legislation around, it's House Bill 1432 and Senate Bill 5353 that I'm going to get to in a second. But a number of us actually brought some examples. I used a couple of examples for our Board of Health, and some other people around the state used some examples. And I'll just give you a couple of examples, because I don't think I mentioned these to you before. So one of the examples we used is that in Clark County, and Janice already mentioned this, our STD rates, sexually transmitted disease rates, are going up across the board. And that includes not just gonorrhea and chlamydia, but also includes syphilis. And for the first time in years, 2016, we had two reported cases of congenital syphilis. And those are babies basically being born infected with syphilis. And that is a preventable tragedy. That should not happen anywhere. And syphilis in babies, congenital syphilis, can lead to severe outcomes, including blindness, deafness, developmental delay, brain damage. It can be a devastating disease. Fortunately, these kids were recognized, and they're doing well and got early treatment. But we're not able, one of the reasons we see STDs going up is not only the behaviors out there, but we just don't have the staff or the resources to go after all the partners for all the cases. I mean, good STD control means that you not only the cases recognized quickly, but that they're interviewed and all their contacts and they are identified and their contacts are brought in for treatment. And if they're infected, their contacts get evaluated and treated. We do the best we can, but we're under-resourced to do that. And these two cases and these two kids were a combination of lack of resources in terms of being able to go after cases that are out there, and also inadequate prenatal care. When we talk about ACEs and all this other stuff, one of the mothers was a drug user, was seen early in pregnancy and screened and was negative, but then was not tested again and did not show up, and was later found to be syphilis positive, so acquired it during pregnancy. And I think the other case didn't get prenatal care at all and was only identified because of the partner in the community was identified with syphilis, and eventually the the case, the mom and the baby were identified. So the bottom line is we lack the resources to go after to be able to do as good a job as we need to around sexually transmitted infections. These are just a couple of examples. You know, Hep C is another one. The other example I brought up is TB. We have the resources to go after the active cases, people who are actually coughing bugs up, but there's hundreds if not thousands of folks who are infected with the disease. They're not contagious yet, they're just, the disease is dormant. We call it latent TB infection, and we just don't have the resources to identify and make sure all those folks get treated. And 10% of them are gonna go on to active disease. So if we're actually gonna eliminate tuberculosis in our community, we need more resources to do that. Those are just a couple of examples. I mean, our ability to do assessment and the fact that we've got now an opiate overdose epidemic are things that we need to be addressing a lot better. And that's why we need funding for foundational public health services. So those are just some examples, and there's more. I can go on for a long time. So anyway, House Bill 1432 and Senate Bill 5353 define the programs and capacities that you need to have to protect their communities. Our Board of Health passed a resolution in support of this. House Bill 1432 has moved out of the House Health Care and Wellness Committee and onto Appropriations. And I believe it's being heard in Appropriations this week. I believe tomorrow. I just looked it up. Representative Harris, who's one of our representatives, is on the House Appropriations Committee. So in your spare time, our Board of Health has already supported this legislation. So in your spare time, if you have it, you might want to give Representative Harris's office a call and say you support foundational public health services. And our Board of Health, so I don't think you need approval from the Board of Health to do that. It's a number of us, by the way, testified in front of both the House Health Care and Wellness and the Senate Health Care Committee. In the Senate, the bill also, so the bill passed out of the House Health Care and Wellness Committee is on to Appropriations. You can call Representative Harris. On the Senate side, it's on its way to Ways and Means. They just don't have a date for it to be heard yet. The Appropriations Committee's hearing is tomorrow. But you might want to contact Senator Rivers because she's our local senator who's on the Ways and Means Committee on the Senate side. And if you can double check that, you can go to the Washington legislature and see who's on what committees. The governor, so there's funding that goes along with this. Public health community asked for, and this is just a down payment, we asked for $60 million for the next biennium, 50 of which would go to local health jurisdictions and the other 5 would go to the Department of Health. The governor, DOH is supportive of this bill, state health department. The governor put $20 million in the budget, but even $20 million is better than what we got now. So our colleagues are across the state. We're still advocating for the $60 million, but honestly, we'll take what we can get at this point. Even the $60 million is just a down payment. So the ask I have of all of you on my computer goes out is to keep up the communication with, whether it be the Board of Health or our representative and senator on the need for this. And if it goes to the full House as well as the Senate, which we hope it will, you may want to talk to the other, your other legislators, because eventually, hopefully, if it gets to the floor of the House and the Senate, all of them will be hearing it. So that was my spiel on foundational public health services, and I probably went on too long. Any questions about that, or?
It's a baby step.
Yeah, I mean, we figured it was more like $300 million than we need. This is going to be a tough time in the legislature because of the McCleary deal and, a lot of pressure to provide the funding for schools. But, our feeling is if kids aren't healthy enough to learn in school, that's a problem, too. So.
Can I have a comment on STDs?
Yeah.
Kind of historically, I can remember when the department here had like at least 3 nurse practitioners and a very active program. It was probably one of the busiest clinics at one time. It was dad and family planning. And I think it provided, it had such a good reputation, the youth and other people in the community, they use the services real, to a very high degree. I know when that disappeared, that was pretty tragic. And I don't know if we're kind of paying the paying for it now or.
Well, it's a combination of things. So when we did that, when we spun off those services, we actually got some concern from the infectious disease folks in the community that we're no longer reaching high-risk populations. And that's why we're providing some of those services along with Cascade AIDS Project, and we have those STD services. But it's not just the direct clinical services, it's all the work in tracking down contacts of cases. Some of these people, as you can imagine, are really hard to find and get them in. In a lot of cases with these STDs, you don't have symptoms. So you know, you can be incubating syphilis for years and not have symptoms. You can have chlamydia and not have symptoms. And you know, it's really hard to track some of these folks down and make sure, and obviously it's transmissible. So you can imagine the amount of work that goes into identifying folks who are infected and then making sure that their contacts get in and get treated. It's a labor intensive process. But yeah, there's a lot. I mean, we need more access points for sure. And then, you know, the two congenital syphilis cases, I think, are a sentinel event. That should not be happening at all. And, you know, there's more of a burden of disease in the community, so this is what we end up seeing. And really, we haven't had any in years. Look back. Not that we know of.
Congenital cases.
Congenital syphilis. Yeah, that makes me think we're going back to the dark ages, yeah, you know?
Yeah. Where were those babies born?
They were born here. They're Clark County residents.
Just the same hospital? Or
I don't have the details, and we haven't given out the details.
Yeah. Are there, like, pockets of, you know, communities that we see syphilis becoming? I mean, I would assume that it's...
We're seeing syphilis rates going up across the state. It's not just here. Calhoun County has highest, I don't know about their syphilis, I know they have high STD rates.
It harkens back to, you know, you have two kids in our county born with congenital syphilis. It's like, we're going back to the dark ages, you know?
Fortunately, these kids, as far as I know, they're doing well and they got, I mean, one of the things you want to do is recognize it early. So the longer they're infected, the more likely, whether they're infected in utero or whether they're infected, you know, they're right before birth, the longer they're infected, the higher the likelihood that they're going to have some of these really nasty outcomes. And I believe they were recognized pretty early and got treated.
This may be out of order, but Madam Chair, can I request that we just have a statement somewhere in the minutes that reflects a statement of gratitude to Dr. Melnick and his team for going to Olympia and aggressively advocating for funding for these very, very important issues in the face of declining financial support and increasing demand. I have a sense of frustration at what is going on at a statewide level and a sense of gratitude for the people in this room who are fighting on behalf of our community. So I just would request that we note that in the minutes.
I agree. I think it's, you know, put it in bold.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just nuts.
Yeah, I think, you know, the fact that you've got congenital syphilis cases is beyond, you know, comprehension. So, and it's preventable. I mean, these are all completely preventable. Okay, should we move on? Speaking of...
Well, I just wanted to take onto that and say that this took me right back. One thing I didn't mention is I worked as a public health nurse on a remote island in Alaska when I was 20-something. And back in those days, STDs were managed very swift and surely. Somebody came, and we didn't have a clinic, we had a house that the health aides and I practiced out of. But if someone came in and they had an STD, we would get the contacts and I'd grab my penicillin and go to their house and take care of it. Mm-hmm. But that's what it takes. It just really takes getting on it right away and bringing it under control and education. But anyway, so I just wanted to share that it really does take manpower, but you can actually make a big difference if you can get out there and do it right then.
Oh, it's fundamental public health stuff. That's why it's a foundational public health service, but it's a matter of having and you have somebody who's got multiple sexual contacts and they're hard to reach, and some of them may be homeless, and we talk about social determinants of health, the amount of work it takes to track people down, especially in an environment like ours, is a lot of manpower.
Well, having an ability for people to get help, and we're just talking about, you know, the STD, you know, how they got changed, you know, those places people don't always know where to go, and how do they find that out if they don't have access to the internet, or how do you find that information out when your resources are so little? So trying to be able to have the, you know, the outreach so that they, and the information for them so that they know where to go. And if that's changing because we're having to change our budgets, and then, you know, the house that used to be there that used to be able to manage that so-and-so told them, you know, 2 weeks ago is no longer in, you know, in open, and they have to go someplace different, and down Portland or wherever that new facility is.
Did you want to move on to the...
drug take that? Is that okay? So... the next item on the agenda is the drug take-back legislation. So, folks familiar with drug take-back, or I can give a very brief, I'll try to be brief about this one. So, everybody knows we have we're having an epidemic of opiate overdose deaths. In fact, opiate overdose deaths in Washington are now the most common cause of unintentional death by injury. I believe they beat out car wrecks statewide in terms of causes of death. Huh?
And nationwide.
It may be nationwide as well. So so there's a lot of things that we're trying to do around opiate, preventing of opiate overdose, and other drug problems as well. So one of the many different ways we're trying to deal with prevention is reducing the availability of opiates and other drugs that could cause harm. And that means a lot of places that people can get drugs, whether they're opiates or other drugs, is out of medicine cabinets and medications that people have laying around. And what we're trying to do is set up a system of drug take-back so that people could actually take medications, take unused medications. And by the way, one of the reasons we have so many unused medications is, and this is a message to physicians as well, is when you're prescribing these medications, don't give people like a month's supply of opiates. You know, give them a few days of what they need, but not so much that it ends up sitting around in people's cabinets. But setting up a system, a sustainable system, so people could take their unused medications to a drop-off site and have them disposed of safely. It's not just a matter of reducing opiate or another drug availability in the community. It's also a matter of protecting the environment, because flushing them down the toilet or throwing them in the garbage, they end up in the water streams. They end up in the, you know, if they go to the dump, they end up in the groundwater. So you want to protect the environment as well, and it's not just opiates, it's things like antibiotics and everything else that's sitting around in cabinets. The problem is, how do you sustain a program like this? It needs to be convenient, and it needs to be a lot of drop-off sites that people can conveniently use. Otherwise, you're not going to use them. The sheriff's office here has had a drug take-back program, but it's really hard for the sheriff to maintain that, because anything brought to the sheriff's office, first of all, has to be put into evidence, it has to be processed right, and having just one location and a sheriff's office to do this is not really a sustainable program. So folks got together and drafted this legislation. It's Substitute House Bill 1047. It's also got out of the Health Care and Wellness Committee, and it's on its way to the Appropriations Committee, also Representative Harris's committee. And basically, it would set up some counties have already developed local ordinances around this. There's four counties that have. But this would set up a statewide system. And the way it would be funded, there'd be multiple drop-off sites. It would be funded well enough. And the way it would be funded is that the pharmaceutical manufacturers would basically pay for this. Now, there's been pushback from the pharmaceutical manufacturers at the state level paying for this. But the bottom line is, when you look at the cost of doing it, it's actually 1/10 of 1% of the cost of drug sales. It's like pennies per prescription, far less than what the drug manufacturers spend on advertising their products, but it's basically 1/10 of 1%, 1/1000th of the cost of the pharmaceutical sales in the state. And but it would be sustainable, and there'd be multiple drop-off sites in our county. I think the minimum is like one for every 20,000 residents, so we'd have a bunch of, and it might be more than that. I'd have to look at the website. They'd be secure, so they'd be inside a hospital or inside a pharmacy where they'd be in, within sight. They'd be secure. They'd be locked and secure, and you'd be able to drop your medications off there during business hours. And it'd be multiple pharmacies around the county, so it'd be convenient for folks. They wouldn't have to go to one sheriff's office site to do this. Most of the testimony has been in favor of this. In fact, the Police Chief and Sheriff's Association has supported this across the state. And I would encourage law enforcement folks who have an opportunity to talk this up with legislators would be helpful. But our board didn't want to be hooked to one piece of legislation on this, but they supported the concept of this. And they had the resolution that our board passed did not want to limit it to drug manufacturers. I think they included healthcare industry partners in their resolution, but they did pass a resolution supporting this kind of legislation. So that's on the agenda for the House Appropriations Committee, I believe, this week. Bill number is SHB. I think S stands for substitute because it's been modified a little bit. House Bill 1047.
I mean, just to make a point about animal medications, I would assume that would incorporate all the, you know, we use a lot of...
Because you guys never...
antibiotics.
You guys never overprescribe that stuff. I can double check that, but I think it would include veterinary medicines as well.
Yeah, okay. But I
can double check that.
Do you know if other states have had, like, the pharmaceutical industry do a similar thing?
Oppose it? I believe there are other states that have this, and I could get that information as well. I don't think we'd be the first one.
One of the more shocking revelations I've heard from the professional staff at Daybreak is that one entry point for kids and opiates is what are called farm parties. And you go home and take whatever you can find in your home medicine chest and go to a party and you put it in a big bowl and take one and see what happens.
Oh,
they're called farm parties, and I think that's the problem with this legislation is directed at is preventing that from happening.
Yeah, I think I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the ways that kids get access to this stuff is from their parents, you know, from their medicine cabinets, yes. And Lord knows what they're getting half the time.
Absolutely. Well, and there's veterinary things in there, too. Well, and isn't there some... There's an elephant sedative that's going around that people are using in different parts of the country.
There's a new morphine derivative that is used on zoo animals that has, I think, become a problem in, not in the U.S. from what I understand, but it overseas.
Actually, there have been problems here in Washington State. So we had a recent death in our county, and the medical examiner basically sent it off for lab testing, and it was furanyl fentanyl. And I can talk about this for a long time, and I apologize, but there's synthetic opiates that are made, and there's one that has a number to it, that was found in this Clark County case, similar to the stuff that they were using on elephants. But these synthetic opiates are many times, in some cases 100 times more powerful than heroin or morphine. They're made, you don't have to have poppies to make them, they can be made in the laboratories, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing so many opiate deaths. So people buy stuff that they think is basically heroin, but it's cut with fentanyl and different kinds of fentanyl. And in fact, I've heard, now this is hearsay, but I've heard that some of the folks who sell the stuff take credit in the fact that it's so powerful that, you know, it's caused overdoses. So it's a selling point for some of the stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of synthetic, including the ones that are used on elephants and large animals, but there's a lot of synthetic opiates going around.
Well, they use Tramadol, which is a controlled substance, phenylpropanolamine, which is a common chronically used medication that's used, and it's a controlled substance that's used for the production of methamphetamines. And people have, I mean, it's controlled, but people have huge vials of that. I mean, it's a chronically used medication in urinary incontinence in dogs that people have tons of, and they do get 3 month supplies, and it's controlled, but somebody could.
So now we have to throw the veterinarians under the bus, too.
Well,
you guys.
It's legal. It doesn't cause, I mean, the dogs aren't abusing it. It's my fault that some quack wants it. But I mean, it's a usable medication with a medical purpose, but in the wrong hands, it can be, you know, and that's not that. But you would want, if that animal passes away, to have an ability for those people to take that, not have their teenage son sell it in their high school, but use it for, put it someplace safe.
Yeah, I believe you'd be able to take this stuff to dispose of it as well. So, but I can double check that.
I would say that's where a lot of people get probably a large quantity chronic dog, cat, or dog. They're not getting ketamine vials, hopefully, but people like to ask for vials of Valium.
They actually come to you and ask for stuff?
Yeah, people.
They say it's for their pets, but...
Oh, yeah, that's a very common way of people getting medications.
Well, my vet gave it to me.
Or they just, you know, their animals in pain, or they keep coming back and their animals in pain, and their animals in pain, and that's not working. It's a problem.
Wow. Any other questions about drug take back?
That's good news.
What's coming up next? The Calais Casino. You want to hear about the Calais Casino?
Are you feeling lucky?
God, I feel like I'm droning on.
You've protected our safe. You've protected our water.
Am I droning on too long?
No.
Have we updated you? Have we talked to you about the Calais Casino and our role and what's happening with that?
A little bit.
So let me go back. Let me give you a little bit of history on this. And Janice and Roxanne, you can start giving me hand signals. If I'm going, the hand signals won't be really nice. So the Calais Casino is opening up sometime in mid-April. And a long time ago, in a galaxy far away, the Calais Casino, the casino is on reservation land, and they're a sovereign nation. A number of years ago, they were planning on building the casino, and they approached the city of La Center, which has a sewer system. And by the way, this casino is $500 million, $500 million. Has anybody been up there yet?
Yes.
I've been on the tour. Have you been on the tour yet?
No, we went and talked to them about integration of internal communications support response.
And by the way, there's going to be at least 13 restaurants there. So,
yes.
And there will be a 400-room hotel going up, but that's in the next phase. So this is a huge undertaking. They approached the city of La Center a number of years ago to see if they could hook into the sewer system. The Calais reservation land is literally inches outside the urban growth boundary. And there's a state law that says you can't hook up. If you're outside the urban growth boundary, you can't hook up to urban services like sewer, for example. Although there's an exception in the law that says for public health necessity, you can. And I'll get into that in a minute. So they approached the city of La Center. La Center wanted to do it because it would have saved, it would have helped pay down the debt on the La Center sewer system. And they had the capacity to do this. And by the way, when the casino is fully up and running, we're talking about 400,000 gallons of effluent a day. The first phase, it'll be about 100,000. And the reason I can do this without looking at notes is that I've been living this for a while. But when the tribe was interested in doing that, but the Card Rooms and the Grand Ronde tribe, which operates the Spirit Mountain Casino in McMinnville, and the county at the time filed suit to block hooking up to the sewer. And it wasn't until recently that the county got out of that suit. And actually, for a while, I was not allowed even to talk. County departments are not allowed to talk to the tribe until several months ago. Well, actually, last year. So the tribe, when they were not allowed to hook into the sewer system, they decided to build their own wastewater treatment system, and the term is called injection system. What they're going to do is they're going to use a very high-tech system that's used elsewhere in the state, and Mark, you may want to weigh in on this at any time, but they're going to basically treat the water to EPA standards. And by the way, because this is on reservation land, sovereign nation, the state has no oversight on this. The only oversight agency is the EPA. Which hopefully will be around for a while. So,
yeah, really.
So the EPA, okay. So the EPA has some oversight on this. The tribe is building, and it's almost done. I saw the treatment facility. It's a very high tech system that will actually get the water, the effluent down to potable, which means drinking water standards as specified by the EPA. Those standards are lower than what the state standards are, but they only have to meet the EPA standards. And by the way, the EPA standards don't test for everything. For example, they don't test for things like personal care products, like medications that might be flushed down the toilet, for example. And then what they're going to do is take this effluent and that's been treated and inject it into the ground, where it'll be there'll be more than 100 feet of ground between that and the aquifer. The aquifer, or the groundwater that sits underneath the tribal land, is called the Troutdale Aquifer, and that aquifer extends all the way into Portland. In fact, Portland, the well fields in East Portland, where they're getting water out of right now because of all the crypto and whatever they had up in Bull Run, is the Troutdale Aquifer. The flow rate from the reservation, though, is north. So the concern is, you know, people have wells that are north of the reservation, whether they may be impacted. But basically, the effluent is treated to potable standards and then injected into the ground, and hopefully there'll be no problem with that. There's been a lot of concern about that. We weighed in on it. Our concern was not that they couldn't do this, and we know that we don't have any jurisdiction over this because it is EPA and even the state doesn't, but we're hoping to work with the tribe to at least have access to the monitoring data. So if something happens, we'd know about it. If there was a breakdown, we'd be able to inform the public about it and work with them to address it. Right now, we're negotiating with the tribe about that. We're now be able to talk with them. Councilor Olson has been taking a leading role in doing this. We've got a letter from the tribe that's positive about working with us, and we're just right now at this point. It's going to go in. It'll be operational in April, but we're hoping to be able to work with the tribe, build a relationship with them, and actually have some access to actually see the monitoring data that they're not only the data that they're submitting to the EPA, but also data that the operator of their treatment plant has access to, which will be much more frequent and more detailed. So we can keep you posted on that. We have some leverage with the tribe now that we're building a relationship up, and they're interested in things like having their restaurants inspected, and we'll be working with them as well. And they're interested in working with the sheriff's office on security issues. So we're hoping to build that relationship. But that's where the casino situation is right now. I don't know if anybody has any questions about that.
I have a question. The only thing that's still learning about the area. So Cowlitz County has a public health department also, right?
Cowlitz County or Cowlitz Tribe? The county has a health department, but the casino land is in Clark County.
Didn't know that.
It's reservation. I'm sorry, I should have said that. So when I was saying La Center, mm-hmm. the reservation land is actually near Richfield and La Center. So it's just inches outside of La Center. The reservation land is in Clark County.
There was even controversy. Was it Cowlitz County? Was it tribal or whatever? It was more or less. My understanding, they had tribal land elsewhere, and they could kind of move around.
But they built it here, yeah. In Clark County. They but it's within tribe. Clark County, but it is...
They had to move the tribe.
So the tribe actually has tribal members throughout the Northwest, and they happen to have they have services down here as well. So there's a lot of tribal members living in Clark County.
Is hooking up to the sewer ever a possibility?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. So it is a possibility, but so the tribe would have saved a ton of money had they been allowed to hook up to the sewer. Hooking up to the sewer would have cost them $3 million. Building their own system has cost them $15
million. Oh, wow.
At this point, I had written a letter, basically, this is a year ago, when Mark Bolt, when he became chair, he asked us to actually look into this. And because of that issue, I said in the law that says for public health necessity, you can hook on to sewer outside the urban growth boundary. So I wrote a letter saying the tribe should be allowed to hook into the sewer. And we brought this to a board hearing, and we thought the tribe would be really happy about it, but they weren't. You could go look at the board hearings on this. And one is they'd already started spending a ton of money on their injection facility. And number two, I think their concerns were if they dropped their injection facility, there's still that lawsuit going on. They might be left with nothing at all. They may still get blocked. Mm-hmm. Here, they have sovereignty, and nobody can tell them not to build. The EPA has okayed this, and nobody can tell them not to do this. So they're going to go. So it's a possibility, but I think it'd be a long time down the road before we got to that.
And you said it's opening in April?
Mid-April, and there's going to be, there will be, this is huge, it's larger than Spirit Mountain, it's going to have, like I said, there's going to be a clothing store, there's a convention center there, a big convention center there, and it'll go along with a 400-room hotel when that gets built out, and it's got at least 13 restaurants, including some national chain type. Yeah,
I don't want to get in the weeds here too much, but remember, it's not funded by the Cowlitz tribe. It's funded by
Mohegan. So I'm glad you brought that. I mean, we're getting into too much detail, but probably a little bit. But the Mohegan tribe, which owns casinos in the Northeast, like in Connecticut, they're familiar with the business. They finance this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So the Cowlitz tribe owes all this money to the Mohegan tribe, and it's going to take them several years to get out of debt.
So they decided that huge budget change. I mean, that's a major budget change, of $15 million versus the $3 million thing. And even if they spent that much money, you know, with their sewer system already, it seems like they had to get that vetted through some higher power.
EPA.
Thing. Well, I know, definitely, but that decision of, we're gonna go ahead with our $15 million plan because...
Oh, the Mohegans were completely
screw us, basically, yeah. And we're gonna.
Yeah, the Mohegans financed it. They're fine with it, huh?
They're fine with it.
Yeah, the Mohegans. I mean, I got a tour. And the Mohegan representative was there. They're totally behind this. They're financing it. They're gonna make this money back many times. They think they're gonna make this money back many times over. So, yeah, I met one of the Mohegan representatives when we were up there for the tour.
We don't have any Mohegan tribes in the Northwest.
No, they're wow. Connecticut. I think
Wisconsin, Connecticut, Minnesota,
they've developed expertise creating and then bringing online really, really big casinos. Okay. And so the Cowlitz, my understanding is they've essentially contracted with this other tribe and this tribal enterprise to set that up for them.
Yeah,
they owe them so the way it works is Mohegans have completely financed this and built this. And then the Cowlitz tribe owes them the money. So they'll be paying off the debt for, I think, 6 or 7 years. And then the Cowlitz tribe will own the whole thing.
Interesting thing, for a while there, well, we still have an Indian war between the Spirit Mountain Indians and the Spirit, because that's going to really set back Spirit Mountain. Because
Spirit Mountain.
Everybody from here going there.
The Grand Ron tribe.
Grand Ron was part of a lawsuit to try to block.
Right, that's what I said earlier. They try to block this. They went together with... By the way, the card rooms are not mom-and-pop operations either. Some of the card rooms are owned by national organizations. And the other thing I heard, and Jane Beto, basically, our prosecuting attorney, has a good history on this. The tribe originally approached the card rooms way back when, and because the tribe... They're going to have blackjack, but they're not going to have poker and other card games. And they actually offered to do a partnership with the card rooms, and they would actually bus people over if they wanted to play poker or stuff. and the card rooms turned them down and then sued them. So
why are they doing? Why are they doing cards? Can they not do?
Cards? I don't know the answer to that. They've chosen not to. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I'm wondering if it's going to be like some tribal casinos where there's a lot of smoking inside.
Thank you for asking that. So yes, the smoking in indoor public places law does not apply. And there will be smoking areas. Yes, there will be smoking inside. And, you know, we asked about that. The answer is, yeah, there will be smoking areas. I don't know about it's up to the restaurants and all that about how they want to be, but the SIP law does not apply.
And the lifespan of the injection system is?
The way it works is they have like these cartridges with the membrane. It's a membrane system, and when one goes out, they can replace it. So I think it's got a pretty long lifespan.
They've got other areas designated, and they kind of alternate between injection wells.
They have enough capacity that if the system, so there's 400 gallons a day at peak, and they have enough storage capacity that if the system stopped working, they could have a couple of days of being able to just store the sewage or whatever, on site. And that 400,000 gallons a day when it's fully operational. When it first gets going, it'll be 100,000 gallons a day.
The question I have about EPA, or maybe I misunderstood something along the way, they review it and everything, but they don't really have 100% enforcement. Is that correct?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that they're basically, the EPA does not have a specific monitoring plan, basically the way it works out is they can ask the tribe for data, but they're not going to require the tribe to report the data to them on a regular basis. And the reporting is fairly... it's not real frequent, and it's a limited amount of data. So it's not the kind of data that we're going to see with the operator of the treatment plant. But we can get you the information. It's in the, there's a basically a book that now I remember the tables. It's table 18.2 and 18.3, and it shows you the frequency and the specific tests that are being done. I could call them up if you're interested, but. The EPA monitoring system is not even weekly, it's like monthly, and it's a limited amount of data.
Is it earthquake proof?
You know, there was one question I did not ask.
I was just curious.
But I don't know about the sewer being earthquake proof either, for that matter.
What would an earthquake do to the whole system?
You know? I
don't know.
Don't have an answer. Well, but I don't know what to do to a sewer treatment plant either.
Maybe.
I can get you the specific... we're asking to be able to have view the data that Parametrics is the company that's installing the system and running it. We want, and their weekly data would include things like nitrates, E. coli, coliforms, and actually on a regular basis there'd be turbidity, and that's what we're asking to do. They don't want to give us the data because they're concerned about public record, but they let us view it, and that's what we're hoping to do. The EPA data is a lot less frequent than that. The other point I want to make, folks, is that if there is a spill, it'll take weeks, if not months and years, for it to get the groundwater flows really slowly. So
okay. We probably need to
too much time.
A little bit behind on time.
Sorry.
But certainly one of the things we can do add this to make sure that we are updating you on this on an ongoing basis, because I do think this is a topic that we're all interested in. So we'll make sure on going forward that we have this as an agenda item and we can update you on the progress. Did you like that? Was that slick and
sly? That's got me. I was talking way too much. Very well done. I was getting tired of listening to myself speak. So
yeah, I just want to give a quick update. We have a change. It's in your packet. It's a new org chart. It's a graph. But as I mentioned earlier, we're transitioning the HIV case management program. It has freed up some of my capacity, and we've been feeling for the last year or so that we've just been stretched too thin, and we think this would be a better way to help meet the goals and outcomes that we hope for our department.
And so I wouldn't really say much other than I'll be over environmental public health. Roxanne will be working with and supervising, I call them our nursing programs.
The nursing programs.
Yeah, the now people-oriented work. Alan has been supervising the municipal, I think that word, disease program because of his medical expertise. And then Jeff will continue to oversee the administrative services of the department. Another change that will be happening is the public information officer, Don Strick, will start reporting to Roxanne so that she can work with him on some of the department's communication plan and also work with Chris in our community engagement to make sure that a lot of those efforts are aligned. The other thing I just want to give you an update is we did do an orientation with our two new counselors, Ellie, how do you pronounce the last
Quiring.
Name?
Quiring.
And John Blum or Bloom?
Blum, you got it. Very good.
It was a great orientation. What we did is we focused on the RCWs and the WACs to make sure that they understood that laws are guiding the work that we do. They guide what Alan does, what Dr. Melnick does. So I think it was a really good conversation with them. Then we gave them a quick tour of the department. But I'm looking forward to the next Public Health Advisory Council, BOH, joint meeting, because I think it'll be a great opportunity for them to learn more about this. Any questions?
Do we want to do a quick food update?
So, we're going to do a quick food update.
Very quick this time. So. You can go on our website and see this, but flu levels are still elevated, but they're dropping. So hopefully, we're still at about 25%. So levels are considered elevated when more than 10% of the clinical specimens are positive. Right now, we're at 20. At our peak, we were up close to 40%. I think we're at 39%. Now we're about 25%. So it's dropping, and I'm hoping in several weeks it'll drop below the 10% threshold. When we're talking about foundational public health services, I just want to give you an idea of some of the stuff we worked on. So we had, during this flu season, we've had 17 long-term care facilities with flu outbreaks. 17. And we work with them really closely to make sure that their residents are protected. But 17 long-term care facilities. And we've actually, at the same time we've had influenza going around, we've had viral gastroenteritis outbreaks at long-term care facilities, and fortunately those are all over, but we've had 6 of those. And both of these...
Seven.
Huh?
There might have been
Tell us about more about that. What is the viral enteritis outbreak?
A viral gastroenteritis outbreak. So you've heard about cruise ship and norovirus?
Well, yeah, no, I feel like it's...
So there's a lot of.
I've never been tested.
Well, you know, so a lot of these are neural, but there's like countless. So basically, the bottom line is a nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and a fairly long incubation period, 24 to 48 hours or so. Highly transmissible. In most of us, it's just really feeling nasty and crummy. But in elderly folks, it can actually wipe them out and puts them over the edge. They get dehydrated and die. It's not just fecal oral, you know, washing your hands, but when you're vomiting a lot, and I'm sorry, I have to be graphic, but in a long-term care facility, people are vomiting a lot, you can actually get viral particles in the air, and you can breathe them in and swallow it, and so it can be pretty nasty. So anyway, for most of us, it's just feeling really crummy for a day or two, but for elderly people, just like influenza, can be very deadly.
A lot of the testing for that just goes unnoticed because a lot of people won't go to the doctor, and you know, it's just those small groups that are in close housing units that get noticed.
You know, you're going to get me talking. Well, it's her fault, but it's kind of like foodborne illness. Okay,
yeah.
All this stuff is really unrecognized because. Somebody, first of all, has to have symptoms, and there are cases that can be asymptomatic. They have to be sick enough to go to the doctor. The doctor has to do the test, it has to get reported to the health department. We learn about it a lot in congregate facilities or during a banquet or a wedding or something. You got a bunch of people talking to each other. But these kinds of illnesses are way underreported. Okay, I'll shut up. It's your fault.
Ellen, I was reading someplace that the flu vaccine this year is about 45% effective. Is that? That's low.
So it's hard to say how effective it is because we'll know more by the end of the season. Okay. We have all the data. Generally, it ranges from about 20% to 60% effective, depending on how good. So there's two different measurements. One is how well is the vaccine matched to the virus? And in this case, the vaccine seems like a pretty good match to what's circulating around. The other question is how effective it is. And obviously, those things are related to each other. But it generally varies between 20 and 60%, depending on the year. We're going to be at the higher end this year. But when I talk to people about this, I say, how many things are there that you can take that's safe and that even gives you a 20% reduction? I think even at a 20% reduction, it's still the best thing you can do to prevent this. So I still recommend, we should still wash our hands, but that probably doesn't come close to the 20% effectiveness. So 20-60% effective is, as far as I'm concerned, isn't, it'd be great if it were more effective than that, but that ain't nothing. Ain't something to shake a stick at, so, whatever the metaphor is. Okay.
Okay, so everyone should have received an email from Lydia, right? For two events that are happening later this week. I think they're both on Thursday, though. Does anyone have that information right in front of them?
Yeah, the Raising of America event is, and it's Are We Crazy About Our Kids? It's a film screening and the community conversation. This is part of our Basis Action Alliance. It's putting this on. That, again, is Thursday, as you mentioned, from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Cascade Park Community Library, which is, and this is in the email, but it's 600 Northeast 136th Street in Vancouver.
By Furstenberg, right by Furstenberg.
Across from Whitney. And then the other thing that unfortunately is happening at the exact same time is the State of the County. And that's at the Hilton downtown from 3 to 5 p.m. So there's a little bit of crossover. But you're welcome to go to either or of those events if you're available. The State of the County will be talking a lot about, the State of the County and the different departments, some of the work that we're doing across the county, and kind of where we're going in the future. So there'll be some high-level discussion.
Can I, the difference between this and the past State of the County, I think we're in an auditorium where the county councilors or commissioners or whatever they used to be would be talking. This is actually going to be an opportunity to network with them. There's going to be tables set up, and there's going to be opportunity to meet and mingle with, I believe it's not going to be a speech kind of set up. Right. So.
Right. And I was also going to say, I checked my calendar. The ACES Action Alliance, the ACES 101 is 1:30 on Tuesday in this room, and the ACES Alliance itself is at 2:30 in this room, right here on the Hilton.
Tuesday 28th?
Yeah, next Tuesday, yes. Tuesday. The 28th, yes.
And we'll have this in our notes too, the notes will go out, but we just want to make sure that everybody gets.
Does the Cascade Park Community Library need RSVPs or?
No, you just go, And it's really good that they're having the table conversations and all that is being captured for notes.
The State of the County is also
Within 3 to 5
p.m. That's so good of the families,
So then Janice had mentioned, trying to have a joint message where we have the counselors come in, and then there's also the joint meetings, the possibility of having a meeting sometime in the spring or the fall of this year. To have everyone come together. The last thing that we wanted to talk about were priorities and presentations for 2017. So looking at community involvement and kind of things that you were interested in talking about, we like to have other people from the community come in and teach us more about what's happening. So some of the ideas that we had just kind of floated it out were the importance of housing in our community, and thinking about the Council for the Homelessness or the Aging Commission. Also the weather and what kind of impacts that has on homeless or those in danger of becoming homeless. And we also talked about the importance of CRESA giving us information always about emergency preparedness, as well as the CHIP and community engagement and the public health strategy planning. We wanted to know if there's other ideas that you might have for engagement that you would like to have at this meeting. Anything that comes across that you'd like to learn more about? Obviously, Dr. Melnick has great ideas about other things that he could teach us more about from what he's mentioned this evening.
You know, Stephanie, one of the things that I think, you know, the Aging Commission actually was meeting tonight, right, same time as our meeting, a little bit earlier, giving the report of all the work they did last year on housing and seniors, and I would like to have somebody from the Aging Commission come and present that here. I think it has great relevance for us, you know, the recommendations they were making to the Board of County Councilors. And then they're going to, this next year, they're going to be working on support services for seniors. And do a whole set of a program throughout the year. So, my daughter, who's pregnant, is on the Aging Commission, so I know a lot about that through her. So,
I have to see if they can alternate getting their meetings at a different time.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to attend, but I'm not going to give up this. Yeah.
This might be a good time for me to chime in, actually. So, over the past year, I have my year anniversary on the 16th, by the way.
Congratulations.
As I've been out in the community, especially working on the CHIP and talking to the partners and the public and our other counterparts everywhere, talking about the CHIP particularly in bringing up you guys as a Public Health Advisory Council, a lot of people didn't know that you existed. And they were very, very interested in learning more. And along with that, you know, it made me think like, okay, well, I'm telling people that this is the body that represents the public to the Board of Health. So they're like, oh, well, who's in there and how are they chosen and all that. So this is something that we started to kind of address one baby step at a time. And besides just these people asking questions like at these presentations and such, I've been working with Lydia to update the website a little bit. I don't know how often you go there, probably not at all. But there is a page on the county website under Public Health for the Public Health Advisory Council. And so we made sure to make sure that's updated. It has basic information. It lists everybody on the role you fill. It lists how people are selected. And when any given seat on the council is ended. I'd also like to move forward in, as I've been kind of integrating my work into our social media strategy and in just generally kind of connecting better with everybody and bringing things closer together, I'd like to highlight your activities more. And one piece of this is that great timeline that shows the successes and the efforts of the Public Health Advisory Council that has come out now and then. It is now on that website. Like when you go to FAC, it's one of the first things you see. It's pretty, it's colorful, and it shows that you've done some awesome things as a council. And you know, I'd like to talk a little bit now and then to the public about, you know, what you're doing. And there are going to be some products of this. It is a public meeting. And we have a space for public comment, so it could mean that people might start coming. Which is something you want to be aware of and maybe talk about a little bit. And of course, if you want to, you know, chat about how we want to message that, that's great. I'm not going to go out and be like, hey, everybody, bring your friends and your school and show up at the meeting. Right now, there's, I think, a line on the website that says, you know, these are available to the public. This is the time. This is the place. Please send Lydia a note if you want to attend. That said, who knows what people will do with that information. So something to put on your radar. I think it's exciting. I think it's going to strengthen the role of the Public Health Advisory Council, and I think it's going to help foster trust between the public and the government as well in kind of having that level of transparency and connection. So any questions on that? And maybe that's something that could be involved in the you know, priorities and how to kind of handle that. And
so you're wondering about like messaging or interactions or
just putting it on your radar for now. It's on the website, and I've been holding off on like, you know, tweeting or putting a Facebook post about you guys, but like I probably want to maybe like every meeting or two kind of highlight what you have been working on or talking about, and you know, kind of push that out to the public and let them see. And yeah, so just it's a heads up. And if you want to think about it, and you know, or if there's anything that you want to especially express through us to the public, or any particular way you want to be presented, you know, let me know.
You know, Chris, it makes me think that, you know, we have, you know, we do our work, and but we, you know, it's just like, you're so right. People, you know, Well, we do this on the Public Health Council, but, you know, we don't have any materials even describing what we do to the public we represent in terms of, you know, creating a, you know, something that if you go to a meeting, you could leave, you know, what is it? Cindy calls it a Slim Jim, you know, or, you know, a thing about the Public Health Council, we meet such and such, we you know, just what the purpose is to advise the Board of Health, you know, what our purpose is, if you're interested in attending, or go here to see what we're talking about on the, you know, very similar to this, something that we could, you know, leave, you know, if we talk to people. We don't have anything like that. We don't have business cards or anything to sort of, we're sort of invisible.
Yeah, and but you're so important at the same time too. Yeah. And as you know, we're getting stronger communication methods through social media, through websites, through being present in the community. You know, I just want to talk about you guys.
You can put the agenda
out here. The agendas, Lydia. You post the agendas ahead of time, and then it's afterwards on the website. Is that right?
At the door.
And they're all up there for several years backwards.
I think the other thing we can certainly do too as you develop this strategy and these ideas is think we can start to bring it to executive and if there's any concerns. You know, I think this is obviously a great idea, and it's really addressing some of the comments that we made at our last meeting, which is we really aren't necessarily getting the word out about some of this work that we're doing, and how do we make sure that we're engaging the community a little bit more. So this is kind of a way of doing that. So maybe what we can also do as part of our executive meeting is as you develop these ideas and these recommendations, we can bring those to you guys, and then we can present to the committee and we can move forward with some of those ideas if you're okay with that.
I really like that idea that you're bringing some attention to this council, and I also especially like what you said about giving the public some guidance about how to show up if they want to come, so that it doesn't become, you know, it could become kind of, even if there's a few people, if they don't know how they're expected to participate, then it could be kind of chaotic.
Yeah.
So, and people want to know how to show up and how to participate if they're going to come to something like this. They can be intimidating. So I think anything help we can give them to make them feel comfortable, but also make it so that two or three people can't take over the meeting.
Right. Absolutely.
Right.
And yeah, like I mentioned before, like I haven't been soliciting this to the public yet because I wanted to let you guys get a heads up first. And just to kind of put a couple things like that might happen. I'm not saying they will, but one is people showing up. And one is maybe people contacting you because your names are on the site too. Be like, oh, I'm interested in, you know, veterinary stuff, and I have feelings about a animal health thing, so maybe they would, you know, find your name and email and send you a note, or whatever other field you're in. So, just, you know, a heads up, that's something that could happen sometimes.
The emails aren't, well, I mean, our personal.
I think it's just your name and the position you fill. Maybe,
That's it. They would contact us through public health.
But, right. Yeah.
Yeah, we won't give out. We will not give out your.
You don't want your telephone number.
We will not. We will not give that out.
You know, one of the things.
It's a public health concern.
You know, one of the things that, you know, Stephanie mentioned, and I think it's all around us, and I think it would be one of the things that I like. I mean, I know a lot about this just because of my involvement. Marla knows some about on the Council for the Homeless, but really to get an update from folks at the Council for the Homeless and the Housing Authority and the City of Vancouver, what's going on with the levy that was passed in the city? What's the state of the housing situation that we have in our community? And all you need to do is drive down around Share House again now and but to actually sort of deal with this issue that we have about the lack of housing in this community. I'd like to have some people come and share with the rest of the council some of what Marla and I know and some of what I know serving on the Housing Authority, but it's a huge issue in our community, you know, homelessness. Homeless kids, you know, the number of kids in schools who are homeless. It's a big, big, big problem, and I think it would be good to educate all of us on that so that we could advocate for that as well. I mean, and just recently, you know, it's really sad that it's not sad. I mean, there's issues, but you know, the idea that was floated for another shelter, you know, because of political issues between Vancouver, the Hostess House being turned, that's dead. And so we're back to sort of finding how can we deal. We don't have no shelter space in the community. So I think, but to update all of us on what's going on would be really important.
Did anyone else have some ideas? You know that. community partners kind of align with what public health is doing and talking about and areas of interest or education that you might feel like you would benefit from? Any ideas for other partnerships you'd like to see come into the meeting?
Maybe at some point, not yet, but maybe the executive director from our accountable community of health, when the time is right, to come and talk about, because that's going to be a huge piece of work and a lot of money is going to flow through there. And I think this group might want to know kind of how that's going to touch a lot of other things.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Kind of a couple comments I have is, on this council, we still don't have any minority representation from the Latino and Black community. Maybe it's something we want to, not that it hasn't been available or whatever, but something to think about. And then to let the community know that we even exist and everything, maybe there's something through the neighborhood associations. I don't know if they have a board, you know, there's what, 20 some odd associations or something. Is they must have a board of some type. Mm-hmm. I don't know, not necessarily that somebody's got to be on the council from that board, but that seems like it might be a good conduit to get public input. Or Chris may be talking to him too.
Lot yet, but give me a reason.
And I'm just looking down at the end of the table. One of the things years ago that I did when I was in leadership Clark County was go and visit CRESA. And it would be interesting to have an update on, you know, all the work that CRESA does. And it would be, I don't know if there's meeting space, but it would be interesting to actually, if people have never seen the operation, it's incredible to see that operation.
That's the other side of the world.
Huh?
Yeah, if you got 911 in Clark County, the phone will be answered by a highly trained, dedicated professional. That ain't me.
But I mean, it's just incredible. When you see it, it's just, you're blown away. And that was, gee whiz, that was many years ago that I saw that. And I'm sure it's vamped because the system was changed and upgraded. But it's an incredible place, a fun place to go and do a site visit.
I'll work with Lydia to schedule one of these at CRESA. And if you're interested in a presentation on emergency management,
yes,
we can coincide with that. However, I'm going to put the onus on y'all, because I don't like public speaking and I don't do it well.
You do it well.
Oh, I've heard you speak.
Yeah,
I don't buy that one.
Thank you, I'm flattered, but.
You're not getting out that easy.
What questions would you like? So instead of one of the standard, hey, we're all going to die in a cataclysmic disaster, what questions do y'all want? So, Lydia, if you would collect those, then when we do that, instead of me pontificating on whatever interests me, I'll actually try to provide some information for y'all.
Where is CRESA?
So, do you know where the Public Service Center is? Mm-hmm. Okay, six-story monstrosity down by the...
By the courthouse?
Down by the courthouse.
Oh, okay.
Franklin right and 13th.
We're right behind it, short, squatty little building.
Oh, okay.
So...
In the shadow of the monstrosity.
Yes.
And when they have CRESA 911 days in September, you get to tour it too.
Mm-hmm. Someone with all the razor wire around.
Yeah.
You know, another thing
there's a new disaster requirement, though, right? That hospitals and organizations have to meet by, is it November of this year? So they're probably, you know, it's probably all part of integration and conversations mm-hmm. that are happening in our community right now. So that would be good for us all to know about.
Yeah, so like I said, whatever questions you want, give them to Lydia and I'll try to put something together that is at least entertaining if it's not informative.
Well, we can also dovetail it with the public health piece, ESF8, and yeah.
Well, and also the idea for this is it's not, you know, you'll have opportunities to weigh in too, but really what we're doing, what the executive team is doing is actually helping to plan a calendar out. So we'll still have our normal updates and our normal stuff that we're doing and the normal work we're doing and your input on the chip. We'll still have all of that stuff, but these are just additional things that we can add to the agenda, to things that you might be interested in learning more about.
Yeah, it kind of makes the experience, I think, with a broader picture. I think it's very engaging.
Yeah.
One of the things that we haven't had for many years, and I go back to when we started, Mark remembers, Paul remembers, our veterinarian at that time talked about zoonotic diseases in terms of what should we as humans, you know, what are some of the trends in the area of and I still.
Alan might just get so excited that he can't stop himself.
I just think it's interesting.
We've had them here.
We love it.
We worried about the prions. Remember all, and it was a presentation at our council, and I would
antigens
like to.
And antibodies.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But I just think we all live in a world of animals and pets, and I just think it would be interesting hear about impact of zoonotic diseases in our community and from our own veterinarian.
Yes. By the way, I just looked at the bill and includes drugs for veterinary use.
Okay, good. That makes me happy.
I can show you it's right there, SHB 1047.
I think that's good. I mean, I think that I hear about people, everybody's got a drawer for their dog or cat. I do.
So they have covered drug, and within that is drugs for veterinary use.
Good.
So earlier we had some council members give updates. Is there anyone else that has an update that they would like to share? Do we want to adjourn the meeting?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Motion to adjourn?
Yeah.
Does anyone want a second?
Second.
Okay. Okay, cool.